news, weather, truth, and fun. We're iHub Radio, homegrown in the Coachella Valley. For a fresh take on the news with Anita Rufus, you won't know if you don't listen.
And thank you so much for listening. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. It is January 5th, 2020. Can you believe it? I'm going to do some talking about the fact that we are now in this year. I like the number, though. 2020, it's a nice round number. And God, I didn't like 2019 for a lot of reasons. Let me start out by with a little bit of personal stuff. You know, a lot of people who do talk radio actually write their shows. That was the thing I was most impressed about when Rachel Maddow was on the radio. She wrote her entire show, but it never sounded written. I can't do that. You know, when I sit in front of this microphone, I always feel like I'm having a conversation just with you, with one person. Maybe you agree with me, maybe you don't, but it's, for me, this is like a conversation. And yeah, I get a little pedantic from time to time because I'm so smart and I know so much and I just want to impress you with how much I know. But between gathering news from print media, from online media, talking to other people, soaking in all of the pundits on everything from Fox to CNN to the networks, I can't write it because it's changing so much all the time. So before I get into 2020, I just want to say the weather right now is absolutely perfect here in the desert, and I feel badly for those of you who are not here. We still have a little snow along the top of the mountains. The sun is out. The sky is blue. The temperature is perfect for me. I still don't have a car. If you listened last week, you know my car got vandalized yet again, second time in 3 months. I'm out $1,000 out of my pocket for deductible, but the damage this time around is currently at $1,200 and climbing because they didn't even realize how much damage there was until they got inside anyway. So I still don't have a car, and I'll find out tomorrow how soon the parts will be coming in. Otherwise, I'm going to have to rent a car. Ah! Our social calendar is starting to fill up. We have friends who are coming back for the season. The new shows coming up at the McCallum Theater that I really want to see. There's some great movies out. I haven't had a chance to see them all. And then there's my gut reaction to what is going on right now in the news. So let me start with a hearty goodbye to 2019. You may not even remember, but we started 2019 with the closure of the government. Remember that? The president thought he was really going to, you know, pressure the Democrats in Congress. Well, all he did was not help anybody. We also had, this was the year where we got rid of plastic straws. Remember plastic straws? I went to a Starbucks this past week and I ordered an iced chai latte, which is now my favorite thing to drink, and because I like tea. And they gave me a straw. And when I opened it, I realized it was one of those heavy kind of paper straws. And I was very pleased because I've been trying to get on board with all of this, what little I do for the environment, and refuse straws where I don't really need to keep the plastic top on a cup. I can take the top off and drink from the cup. So anyway, plastic straws was 2019. Far too many violent hate crimes and assaults. The whole message of white supremacists having entered the mainstream of our political discourse. I mean, there was a time. We've always had hate in this culture. We started this culture with what I have often called the cancer at the core of our culture, which was racism. But at least there was a period of time that I remember where it wasn't okay to talk about these things out loud. People who were white supremacists didn't feel free to come out and march in the streets and proclaim it without realizing that there would be huge pushback from the community. Well, we're not pushing back hard enough, and we have a president who has, with a wink and a nod, made it acceptable for good people on both sides to say and do things. And anti-Semitism is rampant right now. For what purpose, for God's sake? It seems like the two parties live in separate political worlds. They have alternative facts, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. And we've got, you know, impeachment coming up. Assuming that Nancy Pelosi sends the impeachment documents over to the Senate so that they can have a trial. But we don't know at this point, and neither does she. And I respect that she is playing this game down to the nub, because when it goes over to the Senate, Mitch McConnell could just hold a simple majority vote to dismiss the charges and no trial be held at all. And Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to send those documents over unless and until she knows they are actually going to have a trial. So let me tell you that again, because you won't hear much about this if you're not listening really closely to the news. And of course, now the news is dominated by the potential for war, but I'll get to that in a minute. When Nancy Pelosi sends the impeachment documents to the Senate for them to hold a trial, he's impeached regardless of whether a trial is held or not. The impeachment has had a vote in the House, and it is official that the president has been impeached, which is the equivalent of saying he has been formally accused. He has been indicted by the House. But when it gets over to the Senate, Mitch McConnell can, with a simple majority vote, and the Republicans have the majority, a simple majority vote, Mitch McConnell can dismiss the charges and not have a trial at all. The presidential race, Giuliani is now saying out loud the Bidens with an S on the end about money laundering and taking millions of dollars out of Ukraine. The Bidens, they've started that push because it does look like Biden is the favorite, at least right now, but we'll see what happens when voting actually starts to happen. And that black mark against him that he will have to defend in some way is already out there. I personally, Julian Castro dropped out of the presidential race. The Democratic Party has set very difficult standards for people to actually get into the next debate, but actual voting starts in less than a month with the caucuses in Iowa. And after that, it'll be New Hampshire and North Carolina, South Carolina, one of those. But the point is, I now want to put out there that I'm beginning strongly to support the idea of a Democratic ticket that would normally say Klobuchar and Buttigieg, but those are too hard to do on a sign. I like the idea of Amy and Pete.
Me too.
Amy and Pete. You heard it here. Fundraising for the 2020 election. Trump raised a total of $46 million in the last quarter, and he's got well over $100 million, sitting there waiting for his reelection campaign, which has already started. But they keep touting how much money Trump has raised. Now, the truth is, Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders raised $34.5 million. Buttigieg raised almost $25 million. Biden almost $23 million. Andrew Yang raised $16.5 million. And if you add that all up, without even counting the lower level candidates, if you add that all up, that's almost $100 million right there. Right now, comparing the numbers for fundraising for the Democrats with Trump's fundraising is an irrelevant comparison, because what you have right now is Democrats giving money, and others giving money, to Democratic candidates and spreading it around. Wait until there's only one, and then we'll talk about fundraising. An interesting fact that I came across, a majority of Black Americans are more interested in voting in 2020 than they were in 2016. 2016 is when Trump got elected. Black turnout declined significantly from 2012, when they were able to vote for Obama, to 2016. And, you know, all of the fact that a lot of Black voters stayed home contributed to Hillary Clinton's loss. But I found this interesting. Women's top priorities when thinking about this upcoming presidential election. The top priority for women is affordable housing. Top priority for Black men is the cost of health care. And that should be one of the key issues for any of the candidates, because we're about to lose even the protections of Obamacare. Although, I have to say, in California, they have a new policy which says that, much like the way it said it in the Obamacare legislation, Affordable Care Act, in California, if you don't have any kind of health insurance, you're going to have to pay a penalty, because otherwise everybody else who is in the system is subsidizing you when, without health coverage, you just walk into the emergency room. And I think that was one of the best things about Obamacare. An insurance program cannot work unless everybody's in it, so that the risk is spread. Also, with regard to 2020, Russian bots. We've heard a lot about what's going on with the Russian bots. I don't know if you heard, this past week, a video of Joe Biden had been selectively edited to falsely suggest that Biden made racist remarks during a recent speech. This was not what is known as a deep fake, where a video is altered to make it look like somebody is saying something they never said. The Biden video was selectively edited to take out the context within which Biden was saying whatever he was saying, and to make it seem that he was making racist statements. This is what's already happening. And if you aren't double-checking everything that comes up on your Twitter feed or on your Facebook or even in your email, if you're not double-checking all of that and making sure you know where the source came from, who said it, and what backs it up, you are letting yourself be influenced in a way that is very dangerous for our electoral process. 2020 will be a momentous year for America and for the world. I'm going to talk about that in a minute before I get into the fear of going to war. For God's sake, have you ever seen the movie Wag the Dog? This is Anita Rufus. You're listening to iHub Radio.
Live from Palm Springs, she calls it as she sees it. Local talk that's moving the needle. Here's Anita Rufus on iHub Radio.
And again, I thank you so much for joining me every Sunday from 10 to noon here on iHub. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. I mentioned just before the break that I was concerned about these Russian bots and the misinformation that is going on and is rampant in our political system. I want to for a minute talk about a speech that was given this past week. Chief Justice John Roberts Jr., who in fact will preside at a trial in the Senate of the impeachment of the president, he's the guy who sits as the judge. But Chief Justice Roberts was talking this past week about the need for more focus on civic education. He said, at a time when social media can instantly spread rumor and false information on a grand scale, this is something to be concerned about. And if you're retweeting or you're passing on anything without having checked to see if it's true or making sure it came from a legitimate source, you're part of the problem. And the president, to be honest, is part of that problem because he retweets things without checking to see whether or not they're true or what the source was. Anyway, Chief Justice Roberts talked about the importance of independent courts and citizens who understand democracy. We already know that civics is not a big priority in high schools anymore and ought to be. If anything, students are lucky to get one semester of some civics, and a lot of times being spent on the history of our governmental system rather than on making sure they understand how to effectively use the way the system is right now. Anyway, Chief Justice Roberts said, each generation has an obligation to pass on to the next not only a fully functioning government responsive to the needs of the people, but the tools to understand and improve it. He said we should also remember that justice is not inevitable. We should reflect on the duty to judge without fear or favor. This was in speaking to judges in particular. We should reflect on our duty to judge without fear or favor, deciding each matter with humility, integrity, and dispatch. If you'll recall, at a time when President Trump said something about he didn't like a judge's conclusion in a particular case, and he called the judge an Obama judge, Chief Justice Roberts said, we do not have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges. What we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best to do equal right to those appearing before them. Now, we don't always like the conclusions of some of the judges that have been appointed by presidents that we might not have supported, who put judges in place who had attitudes that we do not believe are in the best interest of justice or of the American people. But never forget, and this is the thing I hold on to, never forget that a Republican governor of the state of California who had never judged in a courtroom before, the Republican governor of the state of California, Earl Warren, was made Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and did not judge as if he was what we would now call a Republican judge. The Warren Court became one of the most liberal courts in interpreting the Constitution and the rights of the American people of any. I hold on to that because I truly do believe, not so much with judges being appointed right now by this president who aren't even considered qualified by the American Bar Association. That should be the only hurdle that must be part of the selection process. But I honestly believe that when judges are appointed to the federal bench for life, they then have the freedom to try and judge in the best possible way that they can. So look, 2020 is going to be a big year for us in the world. Politics, to what extent will the president and his campaign be able to get past whatever the Senate trial is going to be? Or will impeachment just be another forgotten series of Trump news cycles? With regard to business, will 2020 finally be the year that we get another recession? Will the tech hand-wringing actually lead to greater regulation or antitrust enforcement? There's a whole lot of people really concerned about privacy and our right as consumers to not be overwhelmed by the tech world. And how will big tech companies police their own systems? With regard to healthcare, president hasn't done anything but, you know, put us on the back burner with regard to having a decent healthcare system. What about energy? What about the biggest oil companies? What about the environment? China, this may be a make or break year for attempts to limit China companies' presence in global 5G networks, which will put us at a disadvantage. There's so much that needs to be done, and we should be taking the lead worldwide in a lot of these things, and we're not, because I believe we're not, because at the moment we have a president who doesn't understand the issues and doesn't want to be told.
News, weather, and a couple of dozen loudmouths. This is iHub Radio. She calls it as she sees it. Now, here's Anita Rufus.
Okay, we have to talk about what's going on with Iran, because it is dangerous. It is concerning. I mentioned at some point earlier about whether you'd ever seen the movie Wag the Dog, and if you haven't, it is really a wonderful movie. But the concept of Wag the Dog is, when all else fails, a president can start a war and the nation will rally around him. The Iranian state TV has just announced that Iran will no longer abide by the terms, any of the terms, of the 2015 nuclear deal, which President Trump threw out when he came into office. At least we had something that for several years was some protection about nuclear weapons in Iran, and at least there was a line of communication. I will just tell you, if I had been president and had received information which appears to be that this general was going to launch more attacks on Americans, which is not news. This has been something that previous administrations, the Bush administration, Obama administration, they all had this kind of information. This guy was the number three person in the entire Iranian government in terms of power and influence. Big hit, no question about that. It would be like the Iranians, having killed Pompeo if he went over to Ukraine. Equally as outraging, for whatever justification. But when President Trump pulled out of that nuclear deal, basically only because it was something that Barack Obama had negotiated, he wanted to escalate. They had the opportunity to talk to them. And let me tell you, here's what I would have done if I were president. If I got intelligence saying that this general was planning some direct attacks imminently, and maybe not tomorrow, maybe next week, maybe next month, but imminently, planning attacks, and I had that kind of intelligence information, I would have reached out to the Iranian government and said, guess what? We know this is what's happening. We have that guy in our sights. You better pull back and you better make some kind of a statement that gives us a way forward. That's what negotiation is all about. That's what having a line of communication is all about. Meanwhile, there was a standoff at the United States Embassy in Baghdad, in Iraq, with thousands of pro-Iran protesters demonstrating how much power Iran does have within Iraq. And yet, we know that recently there have been protests in the streets of Iran against their government. There have been protests in the streets of Iraq against Iran's influence in Iraq. There have been protests in Lebanon, people saying Iran has too much influence. Instead of using that to our advantage against the Iranian government, the president has now totally changed how this is going to go forward. both the Iranians and, by the way, the North Koreans seem to sense that this president is vulnerable. Now, they may not be playing their cards to their best advantage, but Trump's longtime worry that American diplomats and troops in the Middle East are easy targets and that we have to pull back from that region, this action he just took is the opposite of that. It increases the tensions in that region. We're sending more troops. And if you were the government of Iran with all that influence in that region, and this had happened under your watch, what would you do? You wouldn't just sit back and go, well, you know, General Soleimani was the architect of everything, and, you know, we'll just appoint somebody else to that position and we won't respond. Any government is going to respond in some way. And the real fear at this point is that Iran has so much influence with other militia and terrorist groups throughout the Middle East and even in Africa. Those groups are in a position to act against us or our forces or to throw mortars into a base or to try and kill an American tourist somewhere on the streets of somewhere. This is the way Iran can respond. You know, Trump was talking about bringing all our troops home from the Middle East. Let others fight it out for the sand. Now he's adding forces. And they are on a war footing. He has to be prepared for an extreme backlash. And it turns out that his choice to eliminate General Soleimani was not the first choice that was offered to him by our intelligence forces and our defense forces. In previous administrations, they made a conscious choice not to take out this general when they needed to respond in some way to Iran. And people in the administration were shocked that the president chose this path, because they give him that path, they gave him that path, as they have previous presidents, as the perhaps the worst, the most escalating choice, so that a decision could be made for a more rational choice that would not have as much blowback, but that would at least make a statement. When he chose to kill General Soleimani, his own people were shocked. And it makes me ask, does anybody really know what's happening? Is there a strategic plan? The State Department is sending mixed messages to us and to the people who work for us in Iraq. Pompeo had told CNN that killing Soleimani, Pompeo, the Secretary of State. And by the way, why is it the Secretary of State speaking out on this so vociferously and supporting the president's choice, as opposed to the Secretary of Defense, who is in fact in charge of the fact that we took a military action? Pompeo told CNN that killing Soleimani made Americans safer in that region. The embassy in Baghdad told all Americans to get out of Iraq immediately. A former CIA official who has a lot of knowledge of Iran and terrorism, has worked in that area for a long time, CIA, said that the Islamic Republic was more likely to target U.S. government facilities far from the Middle East. He said if they want to hit military facilities in Iraq, Kuwait, Doha, Jordan, all of that area has to be on heightened alert. But we don't know if they might go after our forces or our facilities in Lima, Peru, in Buenos Aires, in Malaysia, in West Africa, in Europe. We know today there was some attack by the Al-Shabaab terrorists who may be influenced and aligned with Iran in Kenya against an American base. Some information that I got hold of says that behind the scenes, how this decision came about, behind the scenes, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, General Mark Milley, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they had all gone to Palm Beach to brief Trump on airstrikes the Pentagon had carried out in Iraq and Syria against Shiite militia groups. One briefing slide listed several follow-up steps that the U.S. could take, among them targeting Soleimani. Unexpectedly, that was the option that the president chose. Evidently, officials in the administration reminded the president that after the Iranians mined ships, downed the U.S. drone, and allegedly attacked a Saudi oil facility, the president had not responded. So he was motivated partly by what he felt was negative coverage of his decision last year to call off the airstrike after Iran shut down our surveillance drone. He was frustrated that details of his internal deliberations had leaked out. He felt he looked weak. And his decision to authorize the killing of Soleimani could, in fact, set off a regional conflagration. And we are forgetting that Saudi Arabia, our ally, has long enmities with Iran. Israel is a potential target. Trump has said that he has identified 52 targets if Iran strikes back after the killing of Soleimani. President said he threatened to hit 52 Iranian sites if Iran attacks Americans or American assets. Meanwhile, there is a Hague Treaty that was signed in 1954, which makes it an international war crime to target historic sites. Now, we know this has been done before. But the fact is, among those 52 targets, the president has specifically said they are 52 Iranian sites, not necessarily military installations, things that he said were at a very high level and important to Iran and the Iranian culture. And he chose 52 in honor of the 52 hostages that were held by Iran in 1979. Well, guess what? Iran said now they've got 35 targets that they can identify, including Tel Aviv in Israel. Oh, for heaven's sake. Somebody has got to help this president understand what he is unleashing. Because I'd be willing to bet he has no idea what the difference is between the Shiites and the Sunnis and how that is influencing what is going on in that region. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal.
because you only think you know the truth. Striking blows against the corporate talk radio monolith in the Coachella Valley. iHub Radio. Participation encouraged, but not required. Here's Anita Rufus.
And thank you so much for joining me. I am live Sundays from 10 to noon here at iHub Radio. By the way, this show does rebroadcast on Monday afternoons from 1 to 3. If you miss it on Sunday, you can always catch it Monday from 1 to 3. You are listening to iHub Radio. I'm talking about the potential for war with Iran and at the very least for escalation, and the fact that the president is now, as a result of his decision to kill General Soleimani, who was the third most important person in the entire administration in Iran. In addition to that, he seems not to understand that the escalation that this could lead to, well, he does understand it required sending more troops at a time when he said he was pulling troops out of the Middle East. Look, the Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, did claim that this action was taken to deter further attacks on Americans, and it is the president's primary responsibility to keep America safe. It is, however, widely anticipated that Iran's going to make good on its threat to avenge the death of Soleimani. There was one article that I read that said Trump has raised strategic incoherence to new levels, acting without so much as briefing the key members of Congress and despite his own party's qualms about a new war in the Middle East. Soleimani was definitely an enemy of the United States. That's beyond question. But we just assassinated this man without any congressional authorization and potentially setting off a massive regional war. America has supposedly a relatively coherent foreign policy, and each president defines it and sets it in their own way. And the president has said, you know, he's really for bringing everybody home. He doesn't want to be fighting wars in faraway places. He doesn't want these seemingly endless wars to be going on. A properly functioning Security Council. We have a National Security Council. Would never have let this happen. Yes, he had it coming. But what strategic sense does it make for the United States to have killed him? President Trump ordered the strike, supposedly prompted as a response to the death of an American contractor on December 27th in a rocket attack from Hezbollah, which is an Iranian-sponsored Iraqi Shia militia. Okay, how much do you even understand? There is Iran, the country. Iran sponsors lots of terrorist groups and lots of upheaval throughout the Middle East. Iran is Shia or Sunni? Well, do you know the difference? There are huge differences. For example, in Iran, they sponsor Shia militia in Iraq. They are very opposed to the Sunni who controls Saudi Arabia. I would be willing to bet any amount of money that if you ask the president about the difference between the Shia and the Sunni, there is no way on earth he could answer that question. But he made himself feel tough. He exercised his executive power and went around the normal channels of decision-making in the government. President Bush and President Obama had considered taking out Soleimani and rejected it for fear of undue escalation and an unnecessary war with Iran and blowing up the Middle East. Evidently, Pentagon officials were stunned by this choice. When the president opted to kill General Soleimani, despite disputes in the administration about the intelligence that had come in warning of threats to American embassies or consulates or military personnel, instead of taking advantage of the protests that were going on against Iranian influence, even in Iraq, and opening channels of communication to try and move forward, now that he had thrown away the agreement that we had to limit nuclear capability with Iran and at least had established some ability to have conversations with them. And the former Secretary of State, who the president, of course, fired because he didn't agree all the time with what the president wanted to do, he had told the president that the Iranians were living up to the agreement. Meanwhile, instead of us taking advantage of the fact that in Iraq they were protesting in the streets against the Iranian influence of the Iraqi government, now, as a result of our killing Soleimani, Iraqi lawmakers have voted to ask all U.S. troops to vacate Iraq. Now, that would hamper our ability to continue fighting against ISIS. And guess what country most wants us out of Iraq? Duh, Iran. It would give Iran something that they have been wanting to bring about for a very long time. And now we've given the Iraqis the excuse to tell us to get the hell out of their country, which gives Iran even more influence in Iraq. Instead of consulting with the key leaders in Congress, in what is basically an act of war, in killing General Soleimani, instead of consulting with Congress, and instead of consulting with our own allies who are supporting us and helping us in the fight against terrorism in that area, the allies warned that further escalation with Iran was almost inevitable. The United Kingdom said further conflict is in none of our interests. Germany warned of a dangerous escalation. But the U.S. government went ahead with the airstrike without informing its European partners. Foreign policy better be a big deal on the agenda at the next Democratic debate for who's going to represent the Democrats against this president in 2020. This is Anita Rufus. You're listening to iHub Radio.